On the show today, escalating violence in the West Bank.
What's going on in this refugee camp is real war. There were strikes from the sky targeting the camp. Every time we drive in, around 5 to 7 ambulances come back full with injured people.
Plus, a new institution in The Hague will investigate Russian leaders for war crimes in Ukraine.
I would say an epoch-defining moment when the civilized world not only voices, but also shows by concrete actions that accountability is what matters the most.
And later, a soccer coach from Togo is changing lives in America, and Barbie is at the center of a Vietnamese political firestorm. Today is Tuesday, July 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. From VOA headquarters in Washington, I'm Steve Karish. We take a look at the situation in Ukraine in just a moment. First, though, violence continues in the West Bank, where so far at least 8 people have been killed in an Israeli drone strike on a suspected militant command center. Gabe Singer of Reuters has the details.
Residents of the city of Jenin say an ensuing gun battle lasted into Monday morning. The Jenin Brigades, a unit comprised of different military groups based in the city's large refugee camp, said it was engaging Israeli forces. The Israeli military said it had struck a brigade's command center in the camp in what it described as a, quote, counterterrorism effort. Khaled Al-Ahmad is a Palestinian ambulance driver who helped transport the injured to the hospital.
What's going on in this refugee camp is real war. There were strikes from the sky targeting the camp. Every time we drive in, around 5 to 7 ambulances come back full with injured people.
An aerial photograph provided by the Israeli military showed what it said was the target, which neighbored 2 schools and a medical center in a densely packed area that houses around 14,000 people in less than a quarter square mile. At least 6 drones were seen circling the city. The drone strikes are the second by Israel in the West Bank in less than 2 weeks. The first strike, which killed 3 militants near Jenin, was the first in the West Bank in 15 years. The next morning, the streets were filled with black smoke and calls to support the fighters from mosque loudspeakers. For over a year, violence in the area has escalated sharply, raising international alarm. In addition to raids in Jenin, the violence has included a series of deadly attacks by Palestinians against Israelis and rampages by Jewish settler mobs against Palestinian villages. Israel captured the West Bank, which the Palestinians see as the core of a future independent state, along with East Jerusalem and Gaza in the 1967 Middle Eastern War. Following decades of conflict, peace talks have been frozen since 2014.
That's Gabe Singer reporting. Ukraine says its forces have retaken 37 square kilometers of territory in eastern and southern Ukraine during the past week as part of its counteroffensive against Russia. Analysts say the recent mutiny against Russia's top commanders may have had an impact on the morale of Russian soldiers on the battlefield. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain has the story.
Russia is continuing its drone attacks on eastern Ukraine, like this one in Sumy. Ukraine's defense ministry said Monday that Ukrainian troops are fighting fierce battles with Russian forces around the eastern flashpoint city of Bakhmut and have retaken territory. Speaking on Saturday in London at the Ditchley Foundation, U.S. Central Intelligence Agency Director William Burns said that the armed mutiny 2 weeks ago by mercenary leader Yevgeny Prigozhin was a challenge to the Russian state and to President Vladimir Putin.
It is striking that Prigozhin preceded his actions with a scathing indictment of the Kremlin's mendacious rationale for the invasion of Ukraine and of the Russian military leadership's conduct of the war. The impact of those words and those actions will play out for some time, a vivid reminder of the corrosive effect of Putin's war on his own society and his own regime.
In Moscow, Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu made his first public comments Monday since the rebellion.
We are talking about the attempt on June 23 to 25 to destabilize the situation in Russia. These plans failed primarily because the personnel of the armed forces showed loyalty to their oath and military duty.
But experts say they agree with CIA Director Burns that the Prigozhin mutiny weakens Putin and may impact the morale of Russian soldiers fighting in Ukraine over time. Former U.S. Ambassador to Russia Michael McFaul spoke to VOA via Skype.
If I were one of those soldiers watching this fiasco, this mutiny, and then Putin response, and Putin pleading with traitors to join his forces. Remember, that's what he's done. He went on national television and he pleaded with these guys, these thugs, these mercenaries, these traitors, these people that killed Russian soldiers. I think that's really important for people to understand.
Another analyst told VOA that Prigozhin's mutiny did not alter the course of the war overnight, but may prove to be a ticking time bomb for Putin. Michael Kimmage is a history professor at the Catholic University of America. He spoke to VOA via Zoom.
Prigozhin showed that it's possible. He showed that it can be done. He showed that in many respects, the resistance to a kind of medium-grade uprising was very weak on the part of the Russian state, and that the support for Putin, both nationally and internationally, was rather tepid.
Meanwhile, a new center for the prosecution of aggression in Ukraine opened on Monday in The Hague, bolstering the capabilities of the Netherlands-based International Criminal Court, which is limited in its mandate to pursue crimes of aggression. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
And in a related story, Kyiv and its Western allies have opened a new center in The Hague that will investigate Russia's leaders for the crime of aggression following its 2022 invasion of Ukraine. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
A new facility in The Hague, known as the International Center for the Prosecution of the Crime of Aggression against Ukraine, will gather evidence on the Russian leadership's decision to invade the country. Ukrainian Prosecutor General Andriy Kostin said its creation was a vital step toward justice.
Today, we gather here on occasion of a truly historic moment. I would say an epoch-defining moment when the civilized world not only voices, but also shows by concrete actions that accountability is what matters the most.
Prosecutors from Ukraine, the European Union, and the United States will build the criminal case against Russia. The center will work alongside the International Criminal Court, which is already investigating war crimes and crimes against humanity, but not the crime of aggression. Philippe Sands is a professor of law at University College London and an expert on international justice.
That issue, aggression, the decision to wage an illegal war, is outside the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court.
The crime of aggression is traced back to the Nuremberg trials at the end of World War II and the prosecution of Nazi leaders. It was then called Crimes Against Peace. No court currently exists with the jurisdiction to hear such a case. But it's vital that those who launched the invasion of Ukraine, including Russian President Vladimir Putin, are prosecuted for the crime of aggression, says Sands.
Why? Because it's the only crime that's a leadership crime. It's the only one where you go straight to the top table. And secondly, because it's the crime which, if you like, begets all the others. If there hadn't been a war, we wouldn't be talking about war crimes and crimes against humanity.
Ukraine says it has documented more than 400,000 crimes related to Russia's invasion. The targeted killing of civilians, such as last week's missile attack on a restaurant in Kramatorsk. Sexual violence, torture, and the forcible displacement of civilians, including children. Kyiv hopes to pin the blame for launching the war on Russia's leaders. Moscow denies committing war crimes, crimes against humanity, and the crime of aggression. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And here are some other stories we're following from around the world. Russian President Vladimir Putin will participate this week in his first multilateral summit since an armed rebellion rattled Russia. Leaders will convene virtually on Tuesday for a summit on the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. That's a security grouping founded by Russia and China to counter Western alliances from East Asia to the Indian Ocean. Nearly 2 years after the chaotic American military withdrawal from Afghanistan, President Joe Biden's statement that the Taliban is helping the U.S. push out al-Qaeda from the war-torn country is reigniting controversy about the presence of terror groups there and the deal that ended the Afghan war. Doctors Without Borders said Sunday that there is a suspected outbreak of measles in an internal displacement camp in Sudan. 13 children have died recently in the suspected outbreak at the camp in Sudan's White Nile state. This is VOA News.
VOA Science Beat. Static electricity might help ticks zoom through the air to grab onto people and animals as they naturally pick up static charges as they go about their days. Those charges are enough to give ticks a boost to their next blood meal, according to a new study published in the June 30 Journal of Current Biology. Deer ticks that spread diseases like Lyme can't jump or fly. They wait with their legs stretched out until a host comes really close. Researchers found that when they charged up electrodes and placed them near young ticks, the creatures would whiz through the air. Static electricity can only pull ticks a fraction of an inch through the air. Though it's a small distance, it can make a big difference for the tiny ticks as they search for their blood meals. I'm VOA's Steve Miller.
From Washington, it's VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Karish. Indonesia and Australia are set for some top-level diplomacy, and Barbie is causing political consternation in Southeast Asia. Those stories coming up. Now, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen will make an official visit to Beijing this Thursday in an ongoing effort by President Joe Biden to stabilize relations. Reuters' Ryan Brooks has more.
The U.S. is sending its second top official to China in a matter of weeks, with Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen traveling to Beijing on Thursday. A senior Treasury official said Sunday that Yellen will meet with senior Chinese officials on a broad range of issues. Those include U.S. concerns about the impact of China's new anti-spying law on foreign firms that operate there. They also say Yellen's visit is part of a push by President Joe Biden to stabilize the relationship between the world's two largest economies and minimize the risk of mistakes when disagreements arise. China's finance ministry on Monday confirmed Yellen's visit from July 6th to the 9th. It comes just weeks after Secretary of State Antony Blinken visited Beijing and agreed with Chinese leader Xi Jinping to ensure the two countries' rivalry does not veer into conflict. Biden later referred to Xi as a dictator, resulting in loud protests from China, but analysts say the remark had little impact on efforts to improve ties.
As the world's two largest economies, we have a responsibility to work together on global issues.
According to the Treasury official who spoke on condition of anonymity, Yellen plans to tell Beijing that Washington will continue to defend human rights and its own national security interests through targeted actions against China, but wants to work together on urgent challenges like climate change and debt distress faced by many countries. The official declined to give details on which Chinese officials Yellen would meet.
Reuters' Ryan Brooks reporting. Time now to meet a soccer or football coach from Togo in West Africa. At his academy in Burtonsville, Maryland, roughly 43 kilometers from Washington, D.C., he's changing lives and training children to be stars on and off the pitch. VOA's Arozuma Campeore has the story.
The players of the Elite Soccer Youth Development Academy, or EZIDA, are taking the pitch with enthusiasm. Their passion for the game creates an atmosphere filled with energy and excitement.
When I play soccer, and I score goals, it makes me get trophies. And they clap for me.
Emmanuel is not the only student who wants to win, but this academy is about more than just trophies and goals. It's a platform for instilling discipline, creating lasting friendships, and fostering an openness that goes beyond the soccer field, says Emmanuel's father, Joel Wenyiblo.
We are following the direction of the coaches and organizers here. No violence, fair play. The spirit that we see should also be reflected in their future so that we can have a more unified society where there is security, harmony, and all will prosper.
As an immigrant from Togo, Coach Adbenyan Amusu, known for his nickname Fofo, started the academy 20 years ago. Amusu says his professional soccer background and unwavering commitment to youth development won the community over.
When I started ESIDA 20 years ago, I faced skepticism and was called lazy. But as we studied the field and realized that soccer could be an instrument to combat poverty, delinquency, and substance abuse, perceptions began to change.
Sortir des enfants de la drogue, les protéger, leur donner une direction.
Okay, go back. Enlist. Thank you.
Good try.
Amuzu's impact has spanned three generations of students. He says former academy students, now adults with families and careers, return every summer to help their former coaches.
On peut jouer le ballon et ne pas gagner des millions.
Playing soccer may not guarantee millions, but it has the power to make a significant difference, changing an entire nation or community. That's what drives me. Sharing, family, children, and the well-being of others. That's what soccer has given me.
As anticipation builds towards the 2026 World Cup, the academy continues to train future soccer players, embodying the belief that the sport is not just about competition, but also about personal growth and community building. Arzuma Kampaure for VOA News, Burtonville, Maryland.
Defense and renewable energy are on the agenda as Indonesia's President Joko Widodo began an official visit to Australia on Monday. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The Indonesian leader is on a three-day trip to Australia. Before his trip, President Joko Widodo told Australian media that the two countries have a great potential for integration. Indonesia has ambitions to become a global hub for the manufacture of electric batteries in vehicles, or EVs. Indonesia is the world's biggest producer of nickel, a key component for EV batteries, but it lacks Australia's reserves of lithium, another critical ingredient. The Indonesian president urged Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese to cooperate in the production of EV batteries during the G20 summit in Bali last November. In a statement, Albanese said, "As one of our closest neighbours, Australia is building extensive cooperation with Indonesia on climate, economic development, education, and regional security issues." In 2021-22, two-way trade in goods and services between Australia and Indonesia was worth $12.1 billion, making Indonesia Australia's 14th largest trading partner. Andrew Hudson from the Centre for Policy Development, a research organisation, told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation there's great trading potential.
Indonesia's economy is forecast to become the fourth largest in the world and larger than Germany or UK in just 7 years. And yet Indonesia remains outside Australia's top 10 trading partners. It's obviously our largest neighbour. So I think there is a huge opportunity there.
Widodo will meet Prime Minister Albanese for talks Tuesday. Albanese will urge for progress on an upgraded defence deal with Indonesia. Although analysts have said that Australia's commitment to the new AUKUS alliance with the United States and Britain has provoked some uncertainty and hesitancy in Jakarta. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And finally today, as Barbie makes her foray from the dream house to the silver screen, she also unwittingly enters international politics. Reuters' Matthew Laratonda explains.
Hi, Ken!
Warner Brothers' highly anticipated Barbie movie has been banned in Vietnam. Why? The film shows a map in one scene with borders that are a highly debated issue of national security and sovereignty, the borders of the South China Sea. Borders that are hotly contested by China, Vietnam, and other countries in the region, including U.S. allies. That's according to Vietnamese state media. The Barbie map shows borders which China uses to illustrate its claims over vast areas of the sea, including parts of what Vietnam considers its continental shelf. Vietnam has also awarded oil concessions there and has repeatedly accused Chinese vessels of violating its sovereignty. Disputes between militaries often happen in the area, such as this incident in February where the Philippine military accused China's Coast Guard of using a laser to try and disrupt a Navy mission there. It's also the scene of a steady military buildup, such as the Spratly Islands, where China's built islands with runways and missiles on reefs. The Vietnamese government previously blocked the DreamWorks cartoon Abominable in 2019 and Sony's action movie Uncharted last year for the same issue with maps. Warner Brothers did not respond to a request for comment.
That's Reuters' Matthew LaRotonda reporting for us. And that's going to wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, visit us online at voanews.com and follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Stay safe and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
Today, Americans celebrate the 247th anniversary of the founding of the United States. On July 4, 1776, the Continental Congress, back then the governing body of the 13th North American colonial governments, approved the final wording of the Declaration of Independence. By this action, the future 13 states declared to the world their independence from the British Empire. The decision to break ties with the British monarchy was years in the making, reflecting the increasing frustration of the colonists with how they were governed. They resented the British government's long-term drive to impose ever tighter control over them, as well as the imposition of exorbitant taxes as a means of discharging the huge debts of the English crown. The Declaration of Independence was the culmination of years of increasingly belligerent attempts on the part of the colonists to shake off these strictures. The American Revolutionary War actually began over a year earlier, in April 1775. When it ended in 1782 with the colonists' victory, the new country was finally free to chart its own course, develop its own manufacturing, export the produced goods, and to pursue trade abroad. The economy grew, and by the beginning of the new century, the United States began to gain a reputation as a land of opportunity, where people could start anew, make their fortunes, and be beholden to no one. America is always becoming, always on the move, always a work in progress. That's the key word, a key idea, a keynote in the life of our nation. Progress, forward motion, the creation of possibilities, the fulfillment of promises. That's the American story, said President Joe Biden. But each day we're reminded there's nothing guaranteed about our democracy, nothing guaranteed about our way of life. We have to fight for it, defend it, and earn it by voting to refine, evolve, and extend the calling of America to move forward boldly and unafraid, he said. This day reminds us of what brought us together long ago, what binds us still, and, at our best, what we strive for. It's we the people. Not a hollow phrase in America. We the people, doing all we can to ensure that the idea of America and the cause of freedom and justice and equality does more than survive the divisions of our time, but that it shines like the sun to light up the future of our world.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.